Welcome to Triple Take, the podcast where we talk to interesting people about the book, album, and film that shaped them. I'm Carla Jean Whitley.
I'm Matt Scalise.
And I'm John Hammontree.
And this week, our guest is our colleague, Bill Thornton. Hey, Bill.
Hey, how you doing?
Doing pretty well. So we invited you here for a couple of reasons. One, we happen to work with some pretty interesting people, so it is fun to bring some of our coworkers on the podcast periodically. You are, of course, a reporter covering the eastern part of the state, and I'm sure that our listeners in that area are quite familiar with your work. But you're also a novelist, and over the past couple of years, you've done a lot of work to promote your latest book. Tell us a little bit about that.
The book is called Centrafields on Fire. It actually came out officially in February. It's Christian fiction. It's a story, if you are familiar with what a mystery shopper is. It is about people who do that sort of thing for churches that kind of come in and take a look at things and find out if you're doing things the right way. What would happen if you had a really committed group of people who did this job and came to a place where all the usual things that they find wrong were wrong? They'd obviously get paranoid and a little bit, you know, frustrated, and it would tell a little bit about who they are and maybe what they believe as well.
So is that a real job?
Actually, it is.
It really is.
The first time I heard about it was in the Wall Street Journal. And it's usually like a retired pastor or whatever. I did not do any research for this. I wanted to create something that would be recognizable and yet slightly off kilter, you know, and not, you know, not to be flippant or whatever, but just to kind of take it to the nth degree to find out, you know, how important certain things are to people when they're worshiping and that sort of thing.
So it's a Christian story, but it sounds like there would be a lot in it that anybody would find amusing.
Yeah, I've had several people who would not read Christian fiction who have really appreciated the book because they you know, there's some very human traits in it. Even if you're not a regular churchgoer, you understand the concept enough so that and the characters there's a kind of Ocean's 11 feel about the whole thing, where you have different characters with different demographics and worldviews, so that you know, if you're waiting to tune in on somebody, here they come, you know, some to help you along in the story.
Perfect. So how does or does your work as a reporter inform your work as a novelist?
It's just about storytelling. That's something that a lot of people ask, and it's funny because it's like just shifting a gear on a car. When I am a reporter, I'm trying to tell a story, but I'm relying on other people to help me do that. If I'm a novelist, I am creating the voices that tell the story at the same time. But with journalism, a lot of it is how you arrange the material, which is the same as a novelist, but it's a much longer, more painstaking process.
Right. So where can people find your book?
It's available at Books A Million. It's also available online, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, just about any kind of online retailer. But it's in bookstores now.
Yeah, which I'm sure does not get old. I love seeing my name on a shelf.
It's cool. It's cool. The best thing is when somebody comes up to you and tells you that they enjoyed your book. You have never met them. You don't know their name. And they weren't necessarily the person you had in mind when you were writing it. But that can be, you know, it's like, wow, you know, I didn't expect that. It's great.
That's awesome. Mm-hmm. Where can people go to learn more about you and your work?
I have a blog, brilliantdisguises.blogspot.com. Also, just follow me on Twitter, Bill and East Alla.
Perfect. All right. So we brought you here today to talk about the art that influenced you. So what book, album, and film did you choose?
The book is called The Name of the Rose by Umberto Eco. The movie is Apocalypse Now, and the album is Let It Be by the Beatles.
All right, well, let's get right into it.
All right, Bill, I think I can see how
The Name of the Rose might have influenced your work because at its core, it's about an outsider who's coming in and investigating a monastery.
Yeah.
Which
yeah.
seems very similar to Set Your Fields on Fire. But tell me, when did you first read this book and why did it have an impact on you?
I first read it about 20 years ago. It was one of those books that you get that kind of mocks you on the shelf. You think, I'm going to read that book later.
Right.
And you keep coming back to it.
Staring at me for
exactly.
years.
And so when I finally did pick it up, first of all, The Name of the Rose, when it came out, I think in 1980, was an international phenomenon because Eco was a professor of semiotics, and he had never actually written a novel before. He was 50 years old. Now, who's going to read a novel in Italian about a murder in a medieval monastery? Turned out it was an international bestseller, and it launched his career, second career as a novelist. But the thing that occurred to me was the just the inventiveness of it all. It's not what you would consider a conventional thriller, and yet it engages you on like three different levels. It's a murder mystery, there's something going on that's historical, and there's also a wonderful story at the core of it about how brilliant people can arrive at the wrong conclusion, and it frames every step that they take along the way. Because in the end, mystery isn't really something that needs to be solved.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's interesting that it was as successful as it was, in part because, as you noted, it was translated. But also, it's not a international medieval thriller in the sense that, like, Dan Brown books are an international medieval thriller. I think it's like if James Joyce wrote a Dan Brown book, because it's filled with signs and symbolism, and it's very dense. And it, you know, I read it as part of a college course on detective fiction, actually, which was fascinating. And we read Edgar Allan Poe and Sherlock Holmes and Borges, and you know, basically, it was set up to read this book because he references all of these things. Character's name is William of Baskerville's. Mm-hmm. I think the blind monk's name is referenced to Borges.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's filled with these dense open text elements, but it's also very readable.
Yeah, and if you aren't looking for those things, you're not going to miss them because you're trying to find out, well, who killed these monks? And it's funny because I actually met Umberto Eco a few years ago.
Oh, really?
He was at Emory University. And it was a great experience because he was lecturing about being a novelist at the age of 50 and above. And after the thing was over, he was out there just kind of sipping on a glass of wine and everything. And he was holding court, as you might say. And it was wonderful because he was a man who gave off this air of immense knowledge, but yet he was funny and entertaining, which is kind of the way the book is. I mean, there's some humor in it. There's obviously that dense textual underside. But if you're not interested in that, that's fine. It's not something that you really need to get to if you're going to appreciate the book on just the surface level. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's one of the things I mentioned was you mentioned Dan Brown. His second book was kind of the prototype for what became the Da Vinci Code, to the point where somebody asked him about that when I was at Emory, and he says, well, Dan Brown, I invented him. He is a character of mine. You know, and it was a standard joke that he would tell at that time, but it really gets to the point that a lot of times I think people pick up fiction because they want to experience something and learn something, but they don't want to feel like they're being taught. They want to find it out on their own, and that's, I think, Eco understood that in a way.
So I'm curious, I believe Eco, in college, he renounced the Catholic Church, or he left the Catholic Church, he stopped believing in God. So as a Christian author, it's interesting to me that one of the books that most shaped you is by an atheist.
Well, it's funny you mentioned that, because Eco may be an atheist, but the characters are not. And one of the things that you get at the end of The Name of the Rose is this understanding that even rationality has its limits, that you can be a very intelligent person and be brilliant and be brilliantly wrong, which is what happens to, you know, the main character. He is in some ways satisfied with his own solutions, and they turn out to be wrong. And I think that's one of the things that we kind of miss out in, you know, modern society, is we tend to think that because we are educated, because we are open-minded enough, and because we have arrived at a level of education, we're not susceptible to the same mistakes and problems that people have made all through human history. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things that Christianity sort of reminds you of, is the idea that you need somebody, and you don't just need that guy over there, you need the guy up there.
That's
humbling, but it's also a point of dialogue.
And I think it's also an interesting reminder that, and I think the book speaks to this very directly, that the church doesn't have a monopoly on knowledge. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, even as Christians, it's important to engage with atheists, with science, and find part of a greater truth in that, because you've got the librarian in the book who basically controls who is able to access mm-hmm. knowledge, which stands in for the Catholic Church in the medieval time. And, you know, we run into that some today, where you have some members of the faith community that, you know, basically want all of a community's knowledge to come from the church, whether it's local mm-hmm. or Catholic or what have you. And so I think when you were writing about this process of people mystery shopping churches, did you do some mystery shopping of churching yourself?
Well, I think everybody does. I think if you experience a church just as somebody walking in off the street, you're going to notice things that people who go there all the time don't notice. Growing up in Gadsden, one of the things that all the Baptists that I would hang out with would do is on Christmas Eve, we would go to midnight mass at the Catholic Church. Well, you would get people who, that was the only time they would come to mass. What are you doing sitting in my seat? You know, that was the first reaction that you would get from people. And everything is new and different, but in their aspect, this is what they grew up in. This is their life. Knowledge is not the same thing as wisdom. Wisdom is the ability to take knowledge and use it in a way that helps not only you, but everybody else. And I think that's one of the things that Echo is getting at in The Name of the Rose, is that there is all this accumulated human knowledge in this library. In some ways, it represents civilization. It is being held on to by a guardian who believes that too much knowledge is a dangerous thing. William of Baskerville, in a way, proves that thesis, even at the same time that he's undermining it, that you can be a very brilliant person and yet you don't know everything. There is always something new to learn. There's always some new lesson that you can gain as a result of your experience and your contact with wisdom.
And as we transition to your conversation with Matt about Apocalypse Now, I do want to just quickly ask, have you seen the film version of The Name of the Rose?
Yeah, and it's cool because, it obviously engages the surface of the story and everything, but to see the library and to see the monastery and Sean Connery as William Baskerville is, you know, it's great casting because William obviously conjures up the image of Sherlock Holmes, but there's this flavor of medieval mystery and everything, and the darkness and the dark corners, and it's just it's a cool experience.
So we're talking about Apocalypse Now. You also mentioned, I think, before we did the show, you wanted to reference the Redux cut mm-hmm. as well. And I have to confess, it's been a while since I saw that, and I don't remember the key differences. But maybe we can get into that. So first off, this is certainly a movie with very literary roots. Can you kind of tell me how you first came into contact with this movie?
I was 16 when I first saw Apocalypse Now. Mm-hmm. And at the time, I thought about becoming a filmmaker, but my reference for filmmaking was George Lucas.
Right.
So I was reading a book about George Lucas, which inevitably led me on to Francis Ford Coppola.
Sure.
And so it was The Godfather and The Conversation and The Godfather 2 and then Apocalypse Now. And Apocalypse Now, after seeing those three films, just blew my mind mm-hmm. because it is this big, messy, epic sort of thing. And, you know, you don't even have to know the backstory of how it was made to see that there's all of these different influences that are coming in. Apocalypse Now is the story of Heart of Darkness by Conrad, mm-hmm. transplanted to Vietnam. But in the process of this story about Martin Sheen's character going upriver to kill Marlon Brando's character, it becomes the Odyssey because they encounter things like the sirens and the Playboy bunnies
right.
and the Cyclops, which is Robert Duvall's character. Right. And you know, it's this... You have the influences of the fact that they were in the Philippines at the same time, and that influenced the Redux version because a typhoon hit, so they decided to keep filming because they had bad weather in Vietnam.
Right.
And then the French plantation sequence, which is probably the biggest departure from the whole thing, like they were going back in time. And everything, it's funny, you know, there are certain cultural experiences where you experience it and you want to know more about it. And Apocalypse Now is one of those things with me that every time I find out some little nugget of information, I want to find out more about it. Because, I mean, you know, just experiencing it on a regular movie level. That movie, like take for instance Martin Sheen's character. He doesn't play a character like that in anything else. He's usually this Kennedy-esque, you know, guy that's, you know, big ideas, lust for life,
sure.
big voice. In this movie, he is a killer, and he is totally, his emotions are almost totally tamped down and everything. In the Redux version, you get a little bit of humor, but not much. He's there to kill somebody, and he's really finding the darkness in his own soul as he goes upriver. And then when he gets there, he encounters Brando, who is crazy, and Dennis Hopper, who may be crazier. And it's just a great experience to watch. It's not a movie for everybody. I mean,
right.
there's a lot of blood and violence and everything. But what you get there's so many levels to it as you're experiencing it.
It's funny that you mentioned that sort of made you attracted to filmmaking or. Possibly just storytelling in general,
mm-hmm.
because it's a movie that almost everybody involved with, literally in some cases, wanted to kill themselves when
oh,
they
yeah.
were making it. It was a
uh-huh.
complete disaster on a sort of creative level, and the fact that it even exists is kind of amazing. But you know, I think if you read a lot about Francis Ford Coppola, he's had a running theme during
mm-hmm.
his career of every project he gets involved in, it's somehow, you know, shapes what's going on in his life and that possibly reflects on the movie. But do you, when you watch something like this, does it, I guess being aware of what was going on in the background, how much does that add to the experience of watching it? Because you know that, you know, with the filmmaker, with Martin Sheen too, who I think almost died a couple of times
yeah.
making it, does that add to, I guess, the experience of the sort of madness, I guess, and darkness of watching it?
One of my favorite scenes in that movie is when they, is the, just before the, I love the smell of napalm in the morning, you know, the air cav unit has attacked the village so they can go surfing. And the bombs are dropping, and Robert Duvall is just kind of looking around. Everybody's take cover, and he's just standing there in the midst of all these craters
mm-hmm.
and everything. The guy goes, "It's still pretty hairy out there, sir. Maybe you ought to surf somewhere else." And he's like, "What do you know about surfing, Major? You're from New Jersey." You know, there's this, if you don't know anything about how the movie was made,
mm-hmm.
you're going to appreciate a scene like that.
Yeah,
you're
sure.
going to appreciate things like the Playboy bunnies scene and the French plantation scene too. Just the fact that you know that, though, in some ways, maybe you enjoy it a little bit better because you can see how much hell they went through making this movie. You know, most movies, what is it, maybe 60 to 90 days of principal photography. Apocalypse Now had 267,
right.
I think. And And it's like that, if you've ever seen the documentary about the making of it, Hearts of Darkness,
yeah.
You know, that's that thing at the beginning when he says, this is a movie about Vietnam. It was Vietnam.
Right.
You know, there were too many of us. We were in the jungle. We had too much money, too much equipment. And little by little, we went crazy. That's him talking about that. And it really, if you look at his career afterwards, it broke him.
I mean,
it totally broke him in half. He has never made a movie that even approaches those four. And, you know, most people would just kill to make one of those. But he made four of them, and he made them all in a row. And he kind of exhausted himself in a way after that because he was going up to that line, mm-hmm. so to speak, you know. But now you can totally watch it. It's kind of like The Name of the Rose. You can watch it, and you don't know any of that backstory, but it's just fantastic, you know.
So you came up, I guess, in that era where there was, you know, people have talked a lot about the late 70s and the filmmaking of that era. It's a very nihilistic time, mm-hmm. very dark. At least in the film industry, I'm sure that was reflected in other art forms too. How much did that kind of shape, I guess, your sensibilities as a writer? That was part of your formation when you're growing up watching this stuff that was really not very optimistic, I would say.
Well, I think the funny thing about that is I grew up. I was born in 1970, so. Mm-hmm. By the time I am approaching this movie, it's the late 80s.
Right.
And the 80s were more optimistic than the 70s,
definitely.
Obviously. But the 70s kind of reminds you that there is an extreme to promise, in other words, that, you know, anybody can be idealistic, but the facts on the ground, at some point, you run up against those. It's kind of the same thing about what, you know, Apocalypse Now is about, why is Kurtz being killed? Because he understands the war better than anybody else. They're back in Washington, but he's there, and he thinks that this is the way the war should be fought. Well, that's reality. We can't have too much reality,
right?
You know,
if you look too closely, you end up falling into it.
But I think in some ways that can also be inspiring, because then you got to find where you can still, you know, where your ground is. Maybe it's not on the mountaintop. Maybe it's down here in the valley. It helps you get the nuts and bolts of life correct. Concentrate on what you can control rather than having the grand vision. And by doing that, you maybe move things an inch or two further along down the road. Doesn't mean you don't have ambition, but it means that you understand the limits of ambition. Some people like cruising that line, kind of like Coppola did, but then there are other people that I'm fine where I am. I want to go just a little bit further, but not too much further.
I've got a feeling. Feeling deep inside, oh
though,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the Beatles.
You okay?
John suggested that I take music this week because I'm such a big fan of the Beatles.
Okay.
And so in preparing for this interview, I got really excited that I get to sit here and talk about the best band of all time.
Absolutely.
Even though it's not the best album of all time, because that's Abbey Road. But, you know, we all have our preferences.
Absolutely.
So, when did you start listening to the Beatles?
When I was in high school, back in the 80s. But in the 80s, nobody listened. It was, you know, it was baby boomer stuff and everything. But when I first came across Let It Be, it sticks out in the whole Beatles catalog because it's chronologically supposed to be the last album that they released. But it's not. It wasn't the last album they recorded. They recorded it before Abbey Road. You know, it began with a great concept. Let's write, rehearse, and record an entire album. And the end of the project will be a concert where we just perform all the songs live. And we'll film it, you know. And
right.
And if you watch it, you can just see the total disintegration of all that. Because instead of it being them in a studio, or them in a studio with Yoko, it's now them in a studio with Yoko and about 50 other people. And all of a sudden, they have to try to be nice to each other, and they are totally tired of each other. And it comes through in the music. But,
oh, yeah.
You know, I mean, there's no escaping it. But what's so cool about it is on the tracks where they are really enjoying themselves. They're still the Beatles. Even, you know, I think if you kind of like the discussion with Apocalypse Now, it's great to see talented people under stress still do what they do at a high level. And then my favorite song on the whole album is I've Got a Feeling.
I love that song.
Yeah. And, you know, the version on the album was recorded on the roof, you mm-hmm. know, for the movie. And what's so great about that is that you can see them there. They're really eating this up, you know. They're really having a good time, even though they're out there, you know, in the cold, playing for stockbrokers down on the street level.
Yeah, it's that track has such energy mm-hmm. to it.
Yeah,
and even with all of these forces, the exhaustion of, you know, being in the spotlight, the band preparing to fall apart. Mm-hmm. When they're playing that song, you still hear the magic.
Yeah.
You still hear that unit operating in the way that really it changed music in mm-hmm. so many ways. Clearly, you and I are both a little bit older than mm-hmm. the Beatles were mm-hmm. at their peak.
Yes.
Slash mm-hmm. at all as Beatles. And yet, we're fortunate to work in a field that draws some creativity mm-hmm. from us. And, you know, we both have lots of side projects as well that play into that. As you continue in your career and in your life, what inspiration or meaning do you draw from this example?
Just the fact that they were always trying something new. They're always trying some kind of way to not necessarily top what they tried to do earlier, but they tried to find some new avenue. Some new avenue for their creativity. And it's not a question, you know, in the beginning I think it was a question of who's got the new idea. Later on it became more of a personality question of who's got the new idea. That comes through, like, say, in if you've ever seen the movie Let It Be, when Paul and George get into a disagreement and George says, I'll play whatever you want me to play, or I won't play at all if you don't want me to play it. Whatever it is will please you, I'll do it. You know, that's his moment where it's like, I've had enough of you. I don't have that problem. I'm me, you know, just by myself. But looking for that inspiration, looking for that new thing, may not always work, but it's the inventiveness, the mm-hmm. fact that there's an opportunity. That, you know, there's always the blank page or the blank screen that has to be filled. What are we going to do today? I think a lot of times if you concentrate too much on that, you get stuck. Just, you know, let it go. And if it didn't work, maybe it got you to the next thing that does work. Mm-hmm. You know, lots of people disparage Let It Be, but they love Abbey Road. You mm-hmm. wouldn't have Abbey Road if you didn't have Let It Be.
Right, right. So 46 mm-hmm. years after Let mm-hmm. It Be was released, you know, Paul and Ringo continue to do a lot of exactly what you're talking about. Yes, they tour and they play mm-hmm. a lot of the Beatles songs. In some ways, they are recreating the 60s on stage. But they're also they continue to release music.
Yeah.
And, you know, having seen Ringo and heard him play some of his more recent stuff, yeah, no, you don't mm-hmm. hit it every time.
No.
You really don't, but...
Well, you know, Paul did that thing a few years ago with the members of Nirvana, where he recorded a song with them. And, you know, you can't think of two creative forces coming together that you wouldn't have expected, but yet it works somehow. You know, you can hear the ideas in there, or, you know, Paul and Kanye. I mean, there's so many different examples. And that's one of the things I think about Paul McCartney as just an artist, is that he's not afraid to collaborate with people because he's done it before. And I mean, if you think about what most people would think after I've collaborated with John Lennon, the idea that I could work with anybody else, but yeah, he's that's okay. You know, I like being around creative people. I like working in that. And that's kind of my inspiration too, because I'm in awe of some of the things that my colleagues here create, and just the things that, people are constantly finding new ways to tell stories in this environment with this technology. And as long as people have been around, they'll be telling stories. So why not try and tell them the best way you can?
So you talk about the collaboration John and Paul had, and wouldn't it be depressing if at 28 years old, the takeaway was, well, I've done that. What am I going to do for the rest of my life? But instead, we look at Paul, for example, and he's old enough to be my grandfather and still doing the thing.
Yeah, and you know, he went through a very bad period of about almost 20 years where, first of all, he was the guy who, quote, broke up the Beatles. And then he was the guy who had the nerve to stay alive after John Lennon's been shot. And there was a lot of hatred towards him for a long time for those two things, and a lot of disparagement of his music for, you know, for whatever reason. No, it's not the same, but he kept going. And it's kind of cool if you've been following him to see where his career is now, this sort of elder statesman thing, you know, because, you know, he and Bob Dylan and to a lesser extent, you know, people like David Bowie to this year and everything have, they have survived and lasted as long, and we admire the fact that they continue to do what they're doing at a high level.
So, final question.
Yeah.
Who's your favorite Beatle? That was a great sound.
I would have to say, if you, John.
Why? Said,
John, because of the just that scenario I presented earlier. Paul comes in with four songs. We got to record tomorrow. Okay, yeah, grab me that newspaper. It says 4,000 holes in. Okay, I can write that. You know, that sort of, I've got to write a song in 20 minutes. This is it. Okay, if you presented that scenario to 99.9% of the human race, you're not going to get a day in the life.
No, you'll get garbage.
You'll get garbage. And, you know, let's give them their due. John had three other people in the room with him and George Martin, and was able to turn that into a day in the life. But it begins with that idea and that sort of sweaty panic of, they want a song tomorrow and I don't have anything. What am I going to do? Now, any journalist who's ever lived will appreciate the ability to just turn it on like that. Now, giving Paul his due, he can do the same thing. I've got 20 minutes. I'm waiting for my wife at the doctor's office. You got a spare room? Okay, here's my guitar. You know, and 20 minutes later, boom, I got a song. But he's been doing it for so long.
Right.
You're getting the broken version there. Mm-hmm. John, you know, he's only been doing this for less than 10 years at that point.
Thanks again, Bill, for joining us for this week's episode of Triple Take. Tell us where we can find you on the internet.
Facebook, it's William Thornton. Twitter, it's Bill in East Allen. I also have an Instagram account, which is the same, Bill in East Allen. Like I said, the blog is brilliantdisguises.blogspot.com.
I'm Carla Jean Whitley, and you can find me on social media at InkStainedLife.
I'm Matt Scalise. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram and other things at Matt Scalise.
And I'm John Hammondtree, and you can find me on Twitter at John Hammondtree and on Instagram at BirminghamHammondtree. And before we go, I want to clear up one quick thing. Carla Jean, we know that Paul is your favorite Beatle. If he were to ask you out today, how would you respond?
I'm ready. What time? Where are we going? I'll be there. I'll definitely be there. Although it would be kind of weird since my cat is named after him.
It's a conversation.
We should probably leave it there. Thanks, y'all. What do I say now?
Your name.
I'm used to doing the intro, not the outro.